Good afternoon. So last time, we started out by looking in detail at how XV6 did context switches. So we mentioned that the exception handling, that just dealing with going from user mode where the application was running to the OS services running, sometimes on behalf of the application, sometimes for some other reason, involves saving the user registers and restoring the user registers. And XV6's choice was that it would reuse that code to do context switches, in that the user part of the context switch was handled by saving registers as you would for any sort of exception and restoring them as you would for any sort of exception, even exceptions that were handled without a context switch, for example, by just doing something in the OS and then going back to the same program that was run. But we had the second part that needed to be handled of the kernel registers. And the solution XV6 used was that it would save them to the kernel stack. And, well, I say the kernel stack, really the current kernel stack, because XV6 would have a separate kernel stack for each process. So it kind of mirror the user notion of a thread with the kernel notion of a thread, by having a separate stack in the kernel for each thing, which would have a separate stack in user mode for normal applications. And it saved the registers and state to the kernel stack using this swtch function. And there were some tricks that they used to make this simpler to write. And one is that they relied on the calling convention to help save values rather than having the switch function do all the work, because they know that some registers are going to be saved when you call a function. They knew that the compiler would generate that code for them, so they didn't need to write it in the assembly they wrote for the switch function. And for the other registers, they had some custom assembly, which both handled pushing and popping registers, but also did the final little piece of work of switching stacks, which we couldn't do just in, say, normal C code. So a question about this, what is the difference in function, what I mean by user register versus kernel register? So the user registers, this is the values being used by an application. Used by an application. And the kernel registers are the values used by an OS, probably used by the OS code, that runs in kernel mode, possibly on behalf of the application. So these kernel registers were for the task which either was on behalf of the application or something like a system call, or interrupting an application for something like a key press that the current application wasn't looking for. And I distinguish between these because XV6 design, at least, maybe you wouldn't always have to do this, explicitly saves and restores the registers the application was using separately from how it deals with the registers that XV6 is using for its own work, which could be on behalf of an application, but isn't actually the code that someone wrote for the application or its libraries. So now that we knew how context switches work, we wanted to talk about creating new threads. And this was a tricky thing with context switches because it seems like that our mechanism for using a context switch relied on us previously having saved the registers of the thing we're switching to. But a new thread, like a new process, doesn't have any registers saved to switch to. So how do we deal with that? And XV6's solution is that it would manually construct a new stack as if it was in the middle of a context switch. So it would, they just figured out, oh, if we had called switch earlier in this new thread, which we couldn't have done because it didn't actually get to run, then it would have pushed these things and these things, and they just put together a stack with those things on it, and this is how XV6 creates new processes, and what's used internally in XV6's implementation of fork is that they know where all these things should be, and they, you know, rather than trying to like copy the current kernel stack, they just construct a new one with all the registers they want to set in the right places on that stack. And I should avoid feedback. Question someone has. And the question is, there's a question, is this XV6 specific or typical of other Unix OSs? This is a very common way of doing this, so I think it would be typical, but it's not the only option. So, question is, what are other options? So, the other option is that you could require switching to a newly started thread to do something other than use the normal context switch function. You could have to, like, two versions of this switch function. And other questions? So then we talked about processes generally, and we had this idea of a process control block. In XV6, this was represented concretely as the struct proc. But the general idea is that operating systems are going to have some sort of data structure which keeps track of all the state of a process. I forgot some important ones on this list. The saved register, I guess I should just say generally the saved registers. You know, so files, its memory, process ID for identifying it, for like killing it or listing it, shared registers, and any other information we need to know about a running program. And we wanted to look at sort of the user space way, the if I'm writing applications that manipulate processes, how do I do it? And to look at that, we wanted to look at a particular example of an interface and operating system I provide for this. And our choice for this class is we're going to look at the POSIX standard, which is basically standardized Unix. So Unix is the original operating system XV6 is based on. And because there were tons of variants of it, some of which shared source code with the original version, some of which didn't, you know, a bunch of manufacturers of that software got together and agreed on a common source code compatible interface. So this is, POSIX specifies, you know, what your C programs need to look like. And because they're all based on this original Unix that XV6 is also based on, there's kind of a canonical implementation, but you don't have to do that as long as the source code wouldn't need to change for applications. And we looked at a very peculiar function in this called fork. So fork is the create a new process function that POSIX provides. And at least conceptually, it basically does a deep copy of the process control block. And because we copy the process control block and that has safe registers and, you know, the safe program counter, we end up returning twice, once in the old process with the old process control block and once in the new one. And fork makes some very selective differences between the two because, well, you have to change something for this to be useful. And probably the most immediately noticeable one is that there's a different return value in the old process, which we call the parent, and the new one, the copy, that we call the child. Another difference is that the process ID of the parent and the child are different because it would be very confusing if we had an ID that was the same between two things. And we're going to finish up talking about fork next before I move on. Any other questions about things we covered last time? Okay. So we were looking at fork, and I mentioned sort of our summary is that when we do a fork, it makes a copy And the copy has a few selected things changing. This includes the return value, not shown on this diagram. It includes the PID, we'll assign a new PID for the copy. And this is the mechanism that POSIX provides for constructing new processes. And here I gave an example output of this program. So we see that we have a call to fork. Since it returns two different things, in the parent process, it returns a positive value. So we execute this code, which ends up printing out get PID of 100, the parent PID, and our child PID, which we got as a return value. In the child only, we run this code, which ends up printing out the PID of the child gotten through get PID. And these return different things in the two processes because we changed the PID as part of the call to fork. And I wrote example output because this isn't the only possible output, because we have two programs running at the same time, and there's no particular reason to think that one will run before the other. In particular, let's go through this exercise. And normally I do the two possible outputs, but that doesn't fit in the Zoom question format. But if you try into any two, that is perfectly fine. And a way I kind of like visualizing this is that we have a single thread running. I'll represent a thread as this sort of wiggly line. This is a common thing you'll see in the literature. And forking copies the state of that, so we end up with two threads. This is sort of how I might like to visualize what's going on. And I'll use that to illustrate sort of how I come up with answers a bit later. So this question, which is getting to something which might be going on, is there a way to ensure that one returns prior to the other using locks? So yes, and there are ways that are not using locks, which we will discuss later today. Give another 10 seconds or so. Okay, so 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 one issue to talk about here is this final print here. And I probably should do it this way. And something that a lot of you might really want is that, well, this tech, you think of this as, if we're in the child, then do this. And the question is, then what happens? And it's very natural to think, well, we've done the child thing, so that's all the child does. But that's not what happens. We're executing code here. The next line of code that gets run is this one. Same thing is true here. So if we do go back to the diagram I was making here, that both the parent and child are going to print out done before they leave main. And when they leave main, they're going to exit because that's what leaving main does. And there's a question, if we had a printf before the fork, would this only print out once? Yes. So if we did like printf this, I guess first here, we'd have first printed out at the top only once, with a little bit of a nit about how buffering works, but basically only once. There's a question about whether this would not actually be printed out until later, but a copy would be kept in a buffer. But hopefully we'd avoid that somehow by, for example, making sure we print things out that end with a new line immediately. And there's a question that, so both processes are running this code? Yes. So both processes end up running, the same code that, effectively does the assign to the PID variable and this if statement. So they both start executing after the fork right here at this if statement. And there's a question, why does the child process print in child if the child PID is 100? So the way fork works is if we're in the parent, it returns the new PID of the child. If we're in the child, it returns 0. One way of thinking about this is that, it returns what getPID won't give you. So in the parent, getPID won't tell us what just happened, but in the child, you have that information, so it gives you 0 instead. And this also explains why PID equals 0 can be true. This is because this is what fork returns in the new process to indicate that you're in the new process. And this is just a choice they made. You can think of other ways of doing this that might make more sense. It's not what POSIX decided to do. So the question that there's a parent pointer in the child processes process control block. I assume you mean you saw this in XV6, but is there a way to list a process's children without checking this field? So different OSs that implement fork have different ways of tracking parents and children. So some of them will have basically a pointer to the child processes. Some of them won't. It depends on what design they did. Whether, they're going to have an easy way of looking that up, or they're like, you're going to need to scan all the processes. Now, as for the possible answers, the answers are all going to be of the form that we have to, do some combination of going down this line. So one way of thinking about it is we can have these different orders, but, we have to have a done written after child 100. We can't have it written before. So of our list that I gave you, We have, so child 100, in child, done. Done is fine, because what we're saying happens is like 1, 2, 3, 4, that's possible. We can also have like child 100, then done, then in child, then done, that's possible. You know, the only rule is that we can't do this before this. You can't like print out done before the thing that's above it in either of these lines. So I believe all the answers that, yeah, that people that have more than 30% selected are possible. And an example of a possible impossible output with two duns would be anything which wants to print out both duns before. So this, for example, is not possible, and we can tell because we can't print out in child before done. Before we have to have a done printed out after in child. So there's a question. So is the fork line run twice, once in each program? So the way I would think it is that the fork line, the call to fork is run once, and it returns once, and it returns twice, once in each program. So we make a new program that's a copy of the original program at the same place. So the second program gets created in the middle of the call to fork. And both of them run everything from the call to fork onwards. The first one, just because that's how a normal function call works. The second one, the child, because that's where it started. And there's a question that we could also have the child run first. Yes. So a valid order would be that we could have in child run first, then this print of done in the child, and then say child 100, and then another print of done. That would be valid. There's nothing that tells you which program gets to run first. Just like if you like have a, like a movie player and a web browser running at the same time, you wouldn't assume that one of them gets the CPU before the other if they're both displaying something. You assume that's alternating a lot if you have one core. Okay, and finally, a reprise of the question about the PID being zero. So the way fork works is that it, in the parent, it returns the PID of the new program, and the child, it returns zero. This is just a convention that Unix chose, because we need to have some way of telling you whether you're in the new or the old process, or else you couldn't do anything useful with fork. And there's also a question of, like, why would we ever want this interface? Why would this be a good interface? And that's a good question, because there's a lot of people who think that it isn't a good interface. But the reason that POSIX chose it is because, well, the original Unix chose it, is because it is pretty easy to implement and does let you do some nice things if you want to have a program that, you know, has multiple things in parallel where you don't want to start a new program. But it does seem like it's going to be inconvenient for the most common way we'll see it used, which is starting a different program. And we'll talk about that next. And there's a question before we move on, that what in this example would get PID in the child return? If you called it here with this assumption that the child is 100, this would be 100 here. And here it would be 99, because this is only run in the parent. And if we say called it here, we'd get, you know, once we'd have get PID run with 100, and another time it would end up running with 99 in the other process. So we have this funny API, funny way of starting new processes that's a little tricky to reason about. And we're actually going to run programs. And I mentioned when I was introducing the POSIX API that we had separated process creation, which we saw being done with fork, from running programs. So we're going to have a way to run a program that doesn't involve starting a new process. So we're going to look at what that is. And that's a bunch of functions that begin with exec. And these replace the current process with, you know, program with a new program in the current process. So this has the same PID, a new process image, and you can think of this as just editing the process control block to replace all the information in there with a program we want to run. And you specify in the variant we'll probably end up using the most, execv, the path of the program to run, the location on disk. And I list an array of arguments as a pointer to pointer to care, terminated by a null pointer because we didn't specify the size. So to give a simple example of execv, I'm going to show it being used with fork because this is most commonly what we'll see. So here I'm calling fork, getting the return value. I guess something which is confusing people is I call this child PID, but maybe a better name would be child PID if parent or something like that, because this is only the actual child process ID in the parent. In the child, it's zero. So if we're in the child process, we're going to actually use execv, and we supply some arguments. In this case, the arguments are ls and minus l. So this is equivalent to the command ls minus l, which you might run from the command line. And we have to specify what program to run. I'm saying that the ls program is located in the slash bins directory by doing this. And execv replaces the current program. So if execv works, it doesn't return. Instead, we're going to end up running, you know, ls. We have a main function. This is where we're going to end up running. We're going to end up going to ls's main function. But if it doesn't work, for example, if this program here doesn't exist or we've ran out of memory, it could return an error instead. And so what I have here is code that prints out the error and then exits so the parent process can figure out what's going on, hopefully. And we'll talk about how it might do that in a bit. Something that's probably worth noting is that I call this the arguments, but the first argument by convention in Unix is the name of the program being run. This exactly becomes argv. So if you remember, argv0 was usually the name of the program being run. You know, so if it was a ls, it'd be ls, and then we had our arguments. This exactly becomes that array that you may vaguely remember using. And there's a question, is there any relationship between bin ls and the actual command ls? On most Unix-like systems, this bin ls is a location of the executable for ls, which is why I chose it for this example. So the shell, when you type ls, knows to search some directories for the ls executable, and slash bin would typically be one of them. So questions about this example here. The question of how does this work on Windows, we will talk about that a little later. Okay, so let's look at sort of a diagram of what exec does. And I'm just showing exec, I'm not showing fork here. So we're gonna know that this is gonna be combined with fork, but like in our example, But, and we'll see why, but we're going to, you know, show what exec does alone. And so exec, when we run it, it's going to change all our user registers to point to, you know, new values, the initial values for starting a program. It's going to change our memory to just be loading the program from disk, setting up an empty stack and heap for it. And, you know, everything else here, though, is going to stay the same. This is going to be important later. For example, the open files will stay the same. And that's very useful because we'd like the program, when it tries to read from its standard in, to read from the same terminal. And this is how we arrange that. That exec doesn't change where standard in comes from. So that's going to be all set up. And there's a little extra work that needs to be done. We also need to copy the arguments. So exec, you know, is called with the, you know, ls minus l in our example. We need to get that to the new program. Typically, those arguments are going to be copied to the stack of the new program. And after we do this, we can get rid of the old data for the original process. And because we're discarding the original process, if you want to run a program and then do something afterwards, you'll typically see a pattern like this, where we'll spawn a new process for the program, but we want to keep doing something else after the program finishes. So for example, if you think of using your command line, when you type ls, after ls finishes, you can type another command. So your command line program called the shell has to keep running afterwards. And the way it achieves this using this exec API is that it uses fork first. So when this replacement operation happens on the child process, the stuff that's being discarded is the copy, but the original's still there. So after the ls command finishes, the original can again prompt for the next command. So there's a question of, in the error case, what happens with this discarded memory? So if you saw my example here, I said that we had this code to handle a potential error after the exec call. So what this means is that when a call to exec fails, the operating system is responsible for making sure it fails before we got far enough to do this, that it's going to fail before we discard the old program. So if it does fail, what we're going to do is, rather than discard the old memory, we're going to get rid of what we set up, restore the original values for everything, and run the program after exec so it can handle it failed. But that's not going to be a common case. Other questions? Okay, there's a question of, what situations do we use exec? Anytime you want, on Unix, you want to start a new program, you have to use exec. That's how you do it. If you want to run a different program, exec is our mechanism for doing that. Now, I showed you this very common pattern of, we use fork to make a new process and we use exec to start a new program in it. And it seems like we're doing something very wasteful, which is that we're copying our program. So remember, you know, if fork, this is a copy, only to discard the stuff we just copied. And we're doing that because we can't fork to create a new program. We can just fork to copy the current program. And we can't exec to make a new process. We can just change the current process. So if we want to, you know, run a new program in a new process, we need to combine fork and exec and do this wasteful copying that we just discard when we exec. And you might say, maybe we could avoid that by having a function that does these together, and the OS could implement that without making a copy we're going to just throw away. And this is, in fact, what Windows does. Windows has a function called create process, which is basically that. And POSIX, in recent versions of the specification, has a function called POSIX spawn, which theoretically would do that, though it's typically implemented using fork and exec. Now, there are some challenges that this creates that fork kind of solves. So the big thing is that if we want to run a new program with sort of a different setup, we need some way of specifying what that is. And by setup, I mean things like, let's say I want to run a program in a different directory, or at least specify what the directory is to be something other than some default. Well, I need a function to set that. With fork, I just need a function to set my current directory in my own program, and I can reuse that to set it for the new program. So the kind of advantage of fork is that we can more easily configure the environment, even if all we're doing is fork and exec. We can more easily configure the environment of the exec program than with one of these APIs where we create a new program from scratch where we have to set all those new values. But from a complexity point of view, in addition to avoiding the extra copying, you know, it could be challenging to implement that copy everything code. It's actually, you know, quite a lot of stuff for a Unix-like OS that maybe would be better avoided. So I mentioned there's this alternate POSIX spawn, so I'll show you kind of what that would look like for OS. So this is the same as my fork exec example. And you see that here, POSIX spawn, I have a place to put the new process ID that's created, the program to run, the arguments as before, and I have a bunch of things that specify changes I want to make to the program state. Do I want to change what files it has open? Do I want some other things changed? Do I want to change its environment variables? So I have to specify, in this case, that I want you to copy the current program's version of each of these. But we have these extra arguments, which in fork plus exec, we deal with by instead like opening files rather than passing some argument here. Okay. And I would say that in addition to sort of Windows choosing it and POSIX creating this call, POSIX spawn, there's some people who believe fork is not a good choice. That was a mistake made in the 70s that we've just kind of kept going. So this is a paper in HotOS, which is meant to be a provocative venue, hot topics and operating systems. But these are some prominent researchers saying that fork is a terrible abstraction for the modern programmer to use, even though it is, you know, very important. Okay, so that's my digression into alternatives to fork. But fork and exec is this very common pattern we're going to keep seeing. Now, if we go back to my example of LS, if you remember how things work, well, if we think about, we have our fork call, it's going to create a child process, which calls exec. Remember, exec doesn't return. So this ends up running LS, I probably should just say. It ends up running, so when things work, when it doesn't fail, it ends up running LS and never goes back, and then LS exits. And if we think of our parent process, well, it's going to keep going and executing at the same time. And if we're thinking of something like a shell, that's not actually what we want. We want to wait for LS to finish. And there is, in fact, a way of doing that, which is going to be this wait PID function. There's also some variants called wait. We're going to look at wait PID, which waits for a process to finish. So So the way it works is you specify the process you want to wait for, which must be a child process of your current process. You can't wait for other processes, sorry. And you specify a place you want to put information about how it terminated, its status, and also some options. We're mostly not going to talk about them. We're going to just mostly pass a zero in, but you can read the man page for details about what those options are. You might say, so what's the status? So this tells us how the process exited. And most obviously, this is where that return value of main gets used. So you remember main can return zero, or you can exit with a zero, or you could like exit with a one. You know, part of what happens is that the status goes there, but there's some other information that's included, and we'll talk about that in a bit. So, example, so typical example of wait PID is we fork. We have our code in the parent here. I've done the opposite of the order I had for the if statements previously. You have code for the child here, and presumably this is going to exit somehow. And when it does, this wait PID will return. So drawing the same diagram, we have our call to fork. The child gets to run until it presumably exits, and the parent calls wait PID, and this is going to not terminate until the child process actually finishes. So this is just going to hang until the child process finishes in some way. So as an example, if we were thinking of a shell, you know, we might, if we say did exec here, you know, so on, the child process would exec, it would run a different program, then it would exit, and only after that finishes would the parent end up going to code after the if statement, which I probably should use colors for this. So we'd run this sort of this pink region here. Okay. So I mentioned so there's a question, how is this setup different than just doing what needs to be done? So I assume you're saying, like, how is this different from just doing whatever's in dot 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 in the parent process? So in the case of this being a call to exec v, there's a particularly relevant difference, is that the call to exec v, I'll do this in, so if we say, yeah, I guess we'll see. If we have exec v, say, ls here, then we'll end up running, I should use here, this will be the ls program, and the ls program, well, it end, you know, ls is going to end with an exit call, and when ls exits, that terminates. And if we did this without forking, then our current program would exit. If we had this alternative of, you know, exec ls, here, we'd end up running ls, it would exit, and we wouldn't get to keep running. So as a way to keep running, even though this thing we're running exits, we start it in a new process. And we use wait PID to wait for it to finish. This is sort of a very common pattern you'll see on Unix-like systems when you want to call a different program. Other questions? Okay. So another thing which could happen that we might be concerned about is that maybe the program we run isn't like LS and it like crashes. And this also deals with that scenario because it's a separate process. That process could crash, could do something weird, and WaitPID will tell us about that. So the status is not the same as exactly what you pass to exit. It includes both whether it terminated normally or not. So this W if exited test is, did it terminate normally? And if it terminated abnormally, it tells you some information about why. So in this example, I'm waiting for a process, and if it terminated normally, I say it returned or exit called with, and I give the exit status, so you know what the return value for main was, or the exit code, passed to the exit function. And I have these other options, the most notable of which is this if signaled. And I'll talk about signals very, very briefly in a second. And if signaled is true, we can get the signal that killed the program from this macro here. So these W functions are all macros defined in syswait.h, and all they do is they decode this integer. So status is an int, and it just, you know, they've done some like bit shifting and anding to put in a boolean and a number, basically. And these macros undo that, so you can actually use the value directly. You know, get the values out of it. And the signal thing, this represents, you know, abnormal termination. So Unix has this mechanism called signals, which are used to tell programs about events. And some of the events that they're used for are things where normally when that event happens, you terminate the program. So this includes things like hitting Control C, using the kill command, a seg fault, something known as a bus error, which is almost the same thing as a seg fault, calling an abort function. But all these things are represented as signals, and the idea is that a process can respond to signals. So for some of these, or for some other signals I'm not listing here, there might be something useful to do. But the signals we're going to care about are mostly things where you're probably just terminating the program because of the signal. And when that happens, you'll learn about it from WaitPID via this WIF signaled and WTermSig macro. So another detail about WaitPID is that you can pass -1 as the first argument, in which case it will wait for all of your child processes at once and just return the PID of the first one that terminates. So you can use its return value to figure out which program just finished. That was my child process that I forked earlier. And you can use this to wait for multiple programs in parallel. And so this is another way in which we can do something that's very different than just running something directly. Okay. And we've seen sort of the typical pattern is that we'll fork, and we want to run a new thing, we'll exec a new program, that program will end up exiting, and WaitPID will let us not finish until it exits. Now, another possibility is that we could fork, and maybe the child program is really fast, and it runs and exits before we start waiting for it. And that's going to be fine. Something that Unix, POSIX says has to happen is that the child process is going to be kept around until we're finished waiting for it, so this WaitPID will work, even if it already exited. And that's going to be okay. And that's important because, if something exits quickly, we want to get that status information to find out why. Did it segfault? Did it exit normally? We still want to know that. And so it will be kept around even if we don't end up waiting until it finishes. Yes, not like it won't be kept running, but information about it will be kept around. Okay. And I guess some notes. So I showed you here that you can wait for all the processes that you started with this negative one. You can also, you know, wait for processes, you know, one at a time. So for example, in this here, I'm forking multiple things and then waiting for them all at once. And you might say, wait a moment, what if one finishes before the other? Well, that's okay because I'm allowed to wait for something that's already finished. So this is a very common design you might see and something that might come up on our next assignment for the shell. Okay, so with that in mind, let's do this exercise. So I have an example which uses fork exec, and we're running a program called echo. So what echo does is it prints out all its arguments after the program name. So for example, running echo x will print out x and a new line. give another 15 seconds or so. Okay, so a majority has selected the best answer, I think, A and C. Hopefully none of you are too miffed that I didn't include the trailing new line. So what happens here is we start running this loop, and initially I equals 0, and we fork. So that means we have one process after the fork where I still equals 0, and a new process that's a copy of the original at that time, where I is going to be equal to 0. And even though we're going to advance I to 1 in the parent process, and even though that might happen before the child process runs, it's always going to be 0 in the child because we made the copy at the time I was 0. We're going to copy that value of I, which is either going to be on the stack or in a register. In either case, it's part of what we copy as doing the fork. So the child process is going to run with I equals 0. It's going to enter this code here with I equals 0. It's going to set args of 1, replacing this arg value here with L1, and call execfi. And when execfi works, it doesn't return. Instead, we end up running echo.exe or the equivalent of that. Actually, it's just going to be called echo on Unix. And echo is going to end by exiting. So we'll never, when this execfi is successful in the child process, we'll never execute any code after it in the child process. Now, the parent process, before we made this copy with I equals 0, it's going to keep running, and it might run before the child or might run after. We don't know. And it's going to go back to this loop, increment I. I is going to be 1. We're going to fork. So we're going to have a new child process where I equals 1. We're going to set args 1 to L2 and exec echo in that child process. And in the parent, we're going to advance I to 2. We're going to finish the loop. And then we're going to call wait on the first child process. So I should actually draw this diagram so it makes sense. So we're going to call exec on the first child process, and then we're going to call it on the second. Call wait on that. Now, the child processes, we don't have any reason to know that L1 gets printed before L2. It could be either way, because even though we know we started the L1 program before the L2 program, because they're all running at the same time, the OS could decide to run them in any order, especially if there's other things it might want to run first on the system. So both L1, L2, and L2, L1 are possible. And regardless of when things get printed out, we're going to wait for both values to be printed before this first program exits because of the wait PID. And it might be the case that the wait PIDs start before the program's finished, or it might be like my diagram here, that they both happen after the echoes have already finished. Either is possible. So there's a question here. Is this if statement to make sure that this code here doesn't run in the parent? Yes, that is exactly what it does. Other questions? Can you execfi the current program? I'm not sure what you mean by that. If you're asking if I could, say, write a program that just does like an execfi of ls, absolutely, that is a valid program, and when you run it, it will switch, it will change into ls and fit and turn it as ls. other questions? Okay. So that's some review of how SEC works. And I have a second exercise you can do on your own. But we're going to talk about shells, which are our next assignment. So the term shell... Oh, question about this example here. In this example, would any code written after execv run? No, any code that I had here would not execute except if execv failed, like because I specified a path to a less that wasn't a real file. And the question, can you, I tell you the answer to exercise two so we can do it ourselves? I might do that on Piazza or similar, or you can run this program. Okay. So our first topic is about here, is about shells. So shell is a program that allows a user, someone at a keyboard, to run applications. And basically it's the user's wraparound process management functions. And our upcoming homework is to make a simple shell. And when we think of a shell that we're going to make for an assignment, it's going to be like a command line you've used before, which is the shell that POSIX specifies. It's a standard Unix shell, but the term is more general. So things like the OSX Finder or the Windows Explorer are shells. They allow you to run programs, but they're graphical. So it doesn't have to be a command line, just a user program for running applications. And things that appear in the POSIX command line are that it will search for programs. So when you type ls minus l, it will realize, wait a moment, this ls program is in the slash bin directory. Or you type make, it will realize, oh, the make program is in the slash user bin directory. We're going to have a shell assignment where you don't do this, but I want you to be aware that it happens. Also, you can run things in the background. So this is specified with an ampersand. And basically what this means is that you fork an exec, but don't wait right away. Right. We're not going to have you do this in the assignment, but it's actually fairly simple to implement the basic part of running in the background. There's some extra work with respect to like eventually figuring out that it terminated, but the basic part is you just forget to wait for it. And we'll have these other features we're going to talk about in more detail. So, and for searching for programs, just so you know, the way this works in POSIX is that there's something called an environment variable. So environment variables are basically key value pairs that are stored as part of the process. There's something that's copied on fork and left unchanged by default by execv. And basically, this is just a list of places that the shell searches. And conceptually, well, I mean, one way the shell could work is by just trying all the possible directories there. Now, there's two more exotic features we're going to have you implement for the assignment, which have to do with files. And one is redirection, another is pipelines. We probably won't get to pipelines today. We'll talk about it more on Tuesday, how that works. Though you don't need to do pipelines for the checkpoint, that you can. The shell assignment has two parts. The first part has a checkpoint. You can finish the checkpoint without doing pipelines. So redirection. So redirection means that you run a program and you can send its output instead of to the terminal to a text file. And you can send its input instead of having it come from the terminal from a text file or some other file. So from a file you specified. And pipelines are that you can run a program and instead of having a second program here's input come from the terminal, it comes from that first program. So the input of some filter is some program, it's output. We're going to talk about how to implement that next time. And I guess I'll note for the assignment that we're going to keep things simple by having everything be space separated, not having you search for programs. Everything space separated, meaning that in my example here, like I just wrote greater than output in our example, we'll have greater than space output. Just to make it so you don't have to fiddle around with text parsing much. And as I mentioned earlier, you don't search for programs, you'll have to type the full name to run it. And also we're going to do something where you have to print the exit code of programs. This is partly so you don't just run a normal shell. And partly because I want you to make sure you actually retrieve the exit code. Okay. Now, we have this feature, these features here, which deal with files. So we need to talk about how do we know, you know, where a program's output or input comes from. And in POSIX, the output and input of programs is always a file. And you might say, wait a moment, but it's going to my terminal. That's not a file. Like, the screen isn't a file. Well, in POSIX, it is. There's one interface for terminals, like printers, network connections, connections to other programs, and regular files on disk, and it's the same interface, and it has open, read, write, close, or the basic operations. Open is, you know, get a handle, which we'll call a descriptor for the file, for a file, and close is, you know, dispose of a descriptor for a file, and read or write are put bytes on it, or put get bytes from it. So basically, by having this one interface, what the POSIX people decided is that for all these different kinds of things, we'll have an interface where we do this open operation to get a handle, what they call a file descriptor, to access the file, and you'll do things in terms of bytes. So read and write are going to take a list of bytes to write in the case of write, and, you know, an amount of stuff to read into a buffer as bytes. And we're going to have a close operation when you're done with a file. And we're going to use this interface, even though, as we're going to learn when we talk about how I/O works, that even though we're working in terms of bytes, often the underlying, you know, hardware doesn't work that way. That's okay. It's the operating system's job to bridge the gap. And you're hopefully familiar with our idea of regular files. So regular files are bytes that are stored in some persistent storage. And we've typically seen them organized into directories. You know, which you might also call folders, in this sort of hierarchy in Unix, the way we specify the location of a file is by having a list of directory names separated with a slash, with a leading slash if we're starting at the base, you know, the what we call the root of the file system, followed by finally the name of some regular file we're going to find there. And the operation in POSIX for opening a file is called open, just open. And it takes a path to a file, which is that, you know, directories and file names separated by slashes, takes some flags, and optionally this mode thing, which we won't talk about that much, but I'll mention what we need to set it to. And it returns an int. So the return value is probably the first thing that's kind of weird. Like, how do we use an int? And we're going to call this int a file descriptor. And this is going to be what we're going to use for read and write and close to access the file after it's open. So the OS is just going to assign us a number to access the file, and that's what open is going to return. We'll talk about how that works later. In particular, we'll look at what it looks like in XV6. The path is our file name, which either can start with a slash to be relative to a single root directory that's common for all programs, Or if it doesn't, it's relative to something called the current working directory, which is kept track of separately for each program and can be changed with chdir, which you may be familiar with from the cd shell command as being the shell's interface to that library call. We'll talk about flags in a bit, but first a diversion into these file descriptors. So open returns a file descriptor, or it returns -1 an error. Like an error is like the file doesn't exist. And this file descriptor, it's a number, and in the most common implementation of POSIX, it's an index into a table of open file descriptions. That's the name POSIX uses for each process. So each process has its own array of open files that other system calls will look up things in. And in XV6, it's actually an array. So each in the struct proc, in the process control block, there's an array of struct file stars. This is the sort of internal type XV6 uses to track files. And the file descriptor is an index into this array. So if open returns 0, that means it put the thing you open at index 0 into this array. And you might say, well, what if I don't have a file open? XV6's choice is that it just puts a null pointer there. And otherwise, this is a pointer to information about a file. And XV6 actually allows these pointers to be shared between processes. So fork copies this array, but it does a shallow copy of the array. So if you, after you fork, you'll have a pointer to the exact same struct file star in the parent and child process. Now you might say, what's in a struct file star? Well, XV6 tracks some information about the file type, and it keeps track of how many processes are using this particular open file, and also whether it's readable or writable. And for regular files on disk, it tracks where we are in the file. Like, are we 1,000 bytes in, 2,000, or so on? You know, so we know write knows where to write from, read knows where to read from. Now, you might say, well, this is nice for accessing new files, but when I like call printf, I don't like specify a file name. How does that work? So one part of this is that there's some special file descriptors, and the convention that POSIX has is 0 is standard input, 1 is standard output, 2 is standard error. This corresponds to standard in, standard out, standard error that you might be familiar with from C. And there's some constants for these numbers in unistandard.h just because you might want to refer to them. Okay. So those are special file descriptors. Now you might say, wait a moment. We were talking about changing a program's standard out. How do we do that if we can't choose the number open returns? We'll talk about that in a bit. I'll just actually skip ahead to that so we can look up how open works. So remember that redirection worked this way. And basically what we're going to do to make this redirection work is that we're going to do our fork. We're going to make a new process that both refer to the same original file. And we're going to want to, before we call exec, change the child process to point to a new place. So we're going to want to open a new file and make it file descriptor 1 in the child process. And that means we need some way of making a file we open become file descriptor 1. And the way we're going to do that is with a library call that POSIX provides called dupe2. So I'll show you. So first of all, what does dupe2 do? Dupe2, it takes a source and a destination, and it basically assigns the source open file description to the destination. So in XV6, it would be this assignment. So as an example of how this might look without the fork exec. So here I open output.txt, I get a new file descriptor for it, and then I make it standard out. And then if I print to standard out afterwards, I get that printed to output.txt. And there's some other work, and we'll go through this again on Tuesday, that I need to worry about. So when I make this dupe, I have O file of FD and O file of standard out file node, which is one, are both pointers to the same thing. I close the original to set O file of FD to null. So I just make sure that I only have one number assigned to this open file. If I didn't do that, I'd have two. So this is sort of the basics of how we can redirect output. And if we think about our original shell command that I showed you here, this example here, the shell just does that before running echo, and that's how that works. And that's where I'll finish up today. I know I'm over time. I wanted to get to enough so we could sanely start the assignment, and next time we will review this and go through an exercise on how dupe2 works, because that's going to be important for the assignment. And then talk about how we do the other part of the other fun shell feature we had, which was pipelines. So the question is, what needs to be done prior to next week's checkpoint? The details are going to be in the assignment. Let me pull up. So if we look at for the assignment, you'll need to do any three of this list. So for printing the exit status, running commands with arguments, and either type of redirection would be sufficient. But you also have other options if you would prefer to do them.